previously arrived at by myself, although the authorities of that time refused to act upon it. Continuous observation of her and of her contrived antics led me to deduce that she was not, in fact, insane, as she pretended, but was attempting to pull the wool over my eyes in a studied and flagrant manner. To speak plainly, her madness was a fraud and an imposture, adopted by her in order that she might indulge herself and be indulged. The strict regimen of the penitentiary where she had been placed as a just punishment for her atrocious crimes not having been to her liking. She is an accomplished actress and a most practiced liar. While among us, she amused herself with a number of supposed fits, hallucinations, caperings, warblings, and the like, nothing being lacking to the impersonation but Ophelia's wildflowers entwined in her hair. But she did well enough without them, as she managed to deceive not only the worthy Mrs. Moody, who, like many high-minded females of her type, is inclined to believe any piece of theatrical twaddle served up to her, provided it is pathetic enough, and whose inaccurate and hysterical account of the whole sad affair you have no doubt read, but also several of my own colleagues, this latter being an outstanding example of the old rule of thumb, that when a handsome woman walks in through the door, good judgment flies out through the window. Should you nonetheless decide to examine Grace Marks at her current place of abode, be pleased to consider yourself amply warned. Many older and wiser heads have been enmeshed in her toils, and you would do well to stop your ears with wax, as Ulysses made his sailors do, to escape the sirens. She is as devoid of morals as she is of scruples, and will use any unwitting tool that comes to hand. I should alert you also to the possibility that, once having involved yourself in her case, you will be besieged by a crowd of well-meaning but feeble-minded persons of both sexes, as well as clergymen, who have busied themselves on her behalf. They pester the government with petitions for her release, and will attempt in the name of charity to waylay and conscript you. I have had repeatedly to beat them away from my door, whilst informing them that Grace Marks has been incarcerated for a very good reason, namely the vicious acts which she has committed, and which were inspired by her degenerate character and morbid imagination. To let her loose upon an unsuspecting public would be irresponsible to the last degree, as it would merely afford her the opportunity of gratifying her bloodthirsty tastes. I am confident that, should you choose to explore the matter further, you will arrive at the same conclusions as have already been arrived at by your obedient servant, Dr. Samuel Bannerling, M.D. This morning Simon is to meet with Reverend Verringer. He's not looking forward to it. The man has studied in England and is bound to give himself airs. There is no fool like an educated fool, and Simon will have to trot out his own European credentials and flourish his erudition and justify himself. It will be a trying interview, and Simon will be tempted to start drawling and saying, "I reckon," and acting the British colonial version of the wooden, nutmeg-peddling Yankee, just to annoy. He must restrain himself, however. Too much depends on his good behavior. He keeps forgetting he is no longer rich, and therefore no longer entirely his own man. He stands in front of his looking-glass attempting to tie his stock. He hates cravats and stocks, and wishes them at the devil. He resents his trousers as well, and all stiff and proper clothing generally. Why does civilized man see fit to torture his body by cramming it into the straitjacket of gentlemanly dress? Perhaps it is a mortification of the flesh, like a hair shirt. Men ought to be born in little woolen suits which would grow with them over the years, thus avoiding the whole business of tailors with their endless fussing and snobberies. At least he isn't a woman, and thus not obliged to wear corsets and to deform himself with tight lacing. For the widely held view that women are weak-spined and jelly-like by nature, and would slump to the floor like melted cheese if not roped in, he has nothing but contempt. While a medical student, he dissected a good many women, from the laboring classes, naturally, and their spines and musculature were on the average no feebler than those of men, although many suffered from rickets. He's wrestled his stalk into the semblance of a bow. It's lopsided, but the best he can do. He can no longer afford a valet. He brushes down his unruly hair, which rebounds instantly. Then he takes up his top coat, and on second thought his umbrella. There's a weak sunlight making its way in through the windows, but it's too much to hope that it won't rain. Kingston in the spring is a watery place. He makes his way stealthily down the front stairs, but not stealthily enough. His landlady has taken to waylaying him on some trivial matter or another, and she glides out from the parlor now in her faded black silk and lace collar, clutching her customary handkerchief in one thin hand as if tears are never far off. She was obviously a beauty not so long ago, and could still be one if she would take the trouble to be so, and if the center parting in her fair hair were not quite so severe. Her face is heart-shaped, her skin milky, her eyes large and compelling, but although her waist is slender, there is something metallic about it, as if she is using a short length of stovepipe instead of stays. Today she wears her habitual expression of strained anxiety. She smells of violets, and also of camphor. She is doubtless prone to headaches, and of something else he can't quite place, a hot, dry smell. A white linen sheet being ironed? As a rule, Simon avoids her type of attenuated and quietly distraught female, although doctors attract such women like magnets. Still, there's a severe and unadorned elegance about her, like a Quaker meeting house, which has its appeal, an appeal which, for him, is aesthetic only. One does not make love to a minor religious edifice. "Dr. Jordan," she says, "I wanted to ask you..." She hesitates. Simon smiles, prompting her to get on with it. "Your egg this morning, was it satisfactory? This time I cooked it myself." Simon lies. To do otherwise would be unpardonably rude. "Delicious, thank you," he says. In reality, the egg had the consistency of the excised tumor a fellow medical student once slipped into his pocket for a joke, both hard and spongy at the same time. It takes a perverse talent to maltreat an egg so completely. "I am so glad," she says. "It is so difficult to get good help. You are going out?" The fact is so obvious that Simon merely inclines his head. "There is another letter for you," she says. "The servant mislaid it, but I have found it again. I have placed it on the hall table." She says this tremulously, as if any letter for Simon must be tragic in content. Her lips are full but fragile, like a rose on the verge of collapse. Simon thanks her, says goodbye, picks up his letter, it's from his mother, and leaves. He doesn't wish to encourage long conversations with Mrs. Humphrey. She's lonely, as well she might be, married to the sodden and straying major. And loneliness in a woman is like hunger in a dog. He has no wish to be the recipient of dolorous afternoon confidences behind drawn curtains in the parlor. Nonetheless, she's an interesting study. Her idea of herself, for instance, is much more exalted than her present circumstances warrant. Surely there was a governess in her childhood. The set of her shoulders proclaims it. So fastidious and stern was she when he was arranging for the rooms that he'd found it embarrassing to ask whether washing was included. Her manner had implied that she was not in the habit of discussing the state of men's personal items with them, such painful matters being best left to the servants. She'd made it clear, although indirectly, that it was much against her will that she'd been forced to let lodgings. This was the first time she'd done so. It was due to an encumbrance which would surely prove temporary. Moreover, she was very particular. A gentleman of quiet habits, if willing to take meals elsewhere, her notice had read. When, after an inspection of the rooms, Simon had said he wished to take them, she'd hesitated, and then asked for 2 months' rent in advance. Simon had seen the other lodgings on offer, which were either too expensive for him or much dirtier, so he'd agreed. He'd had the sum with him in ready cash. He'd noticed with interest the blend of reluctance and eagerness she displayed, and the nervous flush this conflict had brought to her cheeks. The subject was distasteful to her, almost indecent. She hadn't wanted to touch his money in a naked state, and would have preferred it to be enclosed in an envelope. Yet she'd had to restrain herself from snatching it. It was much the same attitude, the coyness about fiscal exchange, the pretense that it hadn't really taken place, the underlying avidity, that characterized the better class of French whore, although the whores were less gauche about it. Simon doesn't consider himself an authority in this area, but he would have failed in his duty to his vocation if he'd refused to profit by the opportunities Europe afforded, opportunities which were by no means so available, nor so various, in New England. To heal humanity, one must know it. And one cannot know it from a distance. One must rub elbows with it, so to speak. He considers it the duty of those in his profession to probe life's uttermost depths, and although he has not probed very many of them as yet, he has at least made a beginning. He'd taken, of course, all proper precautions against disease. Outside the house, he encounters the Major, who stares at him as if through a dense fog. His eyes are pink, his stalk is askew, and he is missing a glove. Simon tries to imagine what sort of debauch he's been on and how long it has lasted. There must be a certain freedom in not having a good name to lose. He nods and lifts his hat. The Major looks affronted. Simon sets out to walk to Reverend Verringer's residence, which is on Sydenham Street. He hasn't hired a carriage or even a horse. The expense would not be justified, as Kingston is not a large place. The streets are muddy and cluttered with horse dung, but he has good boots. The door of Reverend Verringer's impressive manse is opened by an elderly female with a face like a pine plank. The Reverend is unmarried and has need of an irreproachable housekeeper. Simon is ushered into the library. It is so self-consciously the right sort of library that he has an urge to set fire to it. Reverend Verringer rises from a leather-covered wing chair and offers him a hand to shake. Although his hair and his skin are equally thin and pallid, his handshake is surprisingly firm, and despite his unfortunately small and pouting mouth like a tadpole's, thinks Simon, his Roman nose indicates a strong character, his high-domed forehead a developed intellect, and his somewhat bulging eyes are bright and keen. He cannot be over 35. He must be well-connected, thinks Simon, to have risen so fast in the Methodist establishment, and to have procured such an affluent congregation. Considering the books, he must have money of his own. Simon's father used to have books like that. "I am glad you could come, Dr. Jordan," he says. His voice is less affected than Simon has feared. "It is kind of you to oblige us. Your time must be valuable indeed." They sit, and coffee appears, brought in by the slab-faced housekeeper on a tray which is plain in design but nonetheless of silver. A Methodist tray, not flamboyant, but quietly affirmative of its own worth. "It is a matter of great professional interest to me," says Simon. "It is not often that such a case presents itself with so many intriguing features." He speaks as if he has personally treated hundreds of cases. The thing is to look interested but not too eager, as if the favor is being conferred by him. He hopes he's not blushing. "A report from you would be a considerable help to our committee," says Reverend Verringer. "Should such a report favor the theory of innocence, we would attach it to our petition. Government authorities are much more inclined nowadays to take expert opinion into consideration. Of course," he adds with a shrewd glance, "you will be paid the sum agreed on, no matter what your conclusions." "I fully understand," says Simon, with what he hopes is an urbane smile. "You studied in England, I think?" "I began the pursuit of my vocation as a member of the established church," says Reverend Verringer, "but then had a crisis of conscience. Surely the light of God's word and grace is available to those outside the Church of England, and through more direct means than the liturgy." "I would certainly hope so," says Simon politely. The eminent Reverend Egerton Ryerson of Toronto followed much the same course. He is a leader in the crusade for free schooling and for the abolition of alcoholic beverages. You have heard of him, naturally. Simon has not. He emits an ambiguous hmm, which he hopes will pass for agreement. You yourself are... Simon dodges. My father's family was Quaker, he says, for many years. My mother is a Unitarian. Ah, yes, says Reverend Verringer. Of course, everything is so different in the United States. There is a pause while they both consider this. But you do believe in the immortality of the soul? This is a trick question. This is the trap that might put paid to his chances. Oh, yes, of course, says Simon. It is not to be doubted. Verringer seems relieved. So many scientific men are casting doubts. Leave the body to the doctors, I say, and the soul to God. Render unto Caesar, you might say. Of course, of course. Dr. Binswanger spoke very highly of you. I had the pleasure of meeting him while traveling on the continent. Switzerland is of great interest to me for historical reasons, and I talked with him of his work, and therefore it was natural for me to consult him when seeking an authority on this side of the Atlantic. An authority, he hesitates, who would be within our means. He said you are well up on cerebral diseases and nervous afflictions, and that in matters concerning amnesia you are on your way to becoming a leading expert. He claims you are one of the up-and-coming men. It is kind of him to say so, Simon murmurs. It is a baffling area, but I have published 2 or 3 little papers. Let us hope that at the conclusion of your investigations you will be able to add to their number, and to shed light on a puzzling obscurity for which society will give you due recognition, I am sure, especially in such a famous case. Simon notes to himself that although tadpole-mouthed Reverend Verringer is no fool, certainly he has a sharp nose for other men's ambitions. Could it be that his switch from the Church of England to the Methodists had coincided with the falling political star of the former in this country and the rising one of the latter? You have read the accounts I sent you. Simon nods. I can see your dilemma, he says. It is difficult to know what to believe. Grace appears to have told one story at the inquest, another one at the trial, and... after her death sentence had been commuted, yet a third. In all 3, however, she denied ever having laid a finger on Nancy Montgomery. But then, some years later, we have Mrs. Moody's account, which amounts to a confession by Grace, of having actually done the deed. And this story is in accordance with James McDermott's dying words just before he was hanged. Since her return from the asylum, however, you say she denies it. Reverend Verringer sips at his coffee. She denies the memory of it, he says. Ah, yes, the memory of it, says Simon. A proper distinction. She could well have been convinced by others that she had done something of which she is innocent, says Reverend Verringer. It has happened before. The so-called confession in the penitentiary of which Mrs. Moody has given such a colorful description took place after several years of incarceration and during the long regime of Warden Smith. The man was notoriously corrupt and most unfit for his position. He was accused of behavior of the most shocking and brutal kind. His son, for instance, was permitted to use the convicts for target practice, and on one occasion actually put out an eye. There was talk of his abusing the female prisoners also, in ways you may well imagine, and I am afraid there is no doubt about it. A full inquiry was held. It is to Grace Mark's mistreatment at his hands that I attribute her interlude of insanity. There are some who deny that she was in fact insane, says Simon. Reverend Verringer smiles. You have heard from Dr. Bannerling, I suppose. He has been against her from the beginning. We on the committee have appealed to him. A favorable report from him would have been invaluable to our cause. But he is intransigent. A Tory, of course, of the deepest dye. He would have all the poor lunatics chained in straw if he had his way, and all hanged who looked sideways. I'm sorry to say that I consider him to have been part of the same corrupt system that was responsible for the appointment of a coarse and profane man such as Warden Smith. I understand that there were irregularities at the asylum as well, so much so that Grace Marks, upon her return from it, was suspected of being in a delicate condition. Happily, these rumors were unfounded, but how craven, how callous, to attempt to take advantage of those who are not in control of themselves. I have spent much time in prayer with Grace Marks, attempting to heal the wounds caused to her by these unfaithful and blameworthy betrayers of the public trust. Deplorable, says Simon. It might be considered prurient to ask for more details. A sudden and illuminating thought strikes him. Reverend Verringer is in love with Grace Marks. Hence his indignation, his fervor, his assiduousness, his laborious petitions and committees, and above all, his desire to believe her innocent. Does he wish to winkle her out of jail, vindicated as a spotless innocent, and then marry her himself? She's still a good-looking woman, and would no doubt be touchingly grateful to her rescuer. Abjectly grateful. Abject gratitude in a wife being, no doubt, a prime commodity on Verringer's spiritual exchange. Fortunately, there was a change of government, says Reverend Verringer. But even so, we do not wish to proceed with our present petition until we know ourselves to be on absolutely firm ground, which is why we have taken the step of calling upon you. I must tell you frankly that not all the members of our committee were in favor of it, but I succeeded in convincing them of the need for an informed and objective viewpoint. A diagnosis of latent insanity at the time of the murders, for instance. However, the utmost caution and rectitude must be observed. There is still a widespread feeling against Grace Marks, and this is a most partisan country. The Tories appear to have confused Grace with the Irish question, although she is a Protestant. And to consider the murder of a single Tory gentleman, however worthy the gentleman and however regrettable the murder, to be the same thing as the insurrection of an entire race. Every country is plagued by factionalism, says Simon tactfully. Even apart from that, says Reverend Verringer, we are caught between the notion of a possibly innocent woman whom many believe to be guilty and a possibly guilty woman whom some believe to be innocent. We would not want the opponents of reform to be given an opportunity of crowing over us, but, as our Lord says, the truth shall make you free. The truth may well turn out to be stranger than we think, says Simon. It may be that much of what we are accustomed to describe as evil, and evil freely chosen, is instead an illness due to some lesion of the nervous system, and that the devil himself is simply a malformation of the cerebrum. Reverend Verringer smiles. Oh, I doubt it will go so far as that, he says. No matter what science may accomplish in the future, the devil will always be at large. I believe you have been invited to the governor's house on Sunday afternoon. I have had that honor, says Simon politely. He has been intending to make his excuses. I look forward to seeing you there, says Reverend Verringer. I myself arranged the invitation for you. The governor's excellent wife is an invaluable member of our committee. At the governor's residence, Simon is directed to the parlor, which is almost large enough to be called a drawing room. All possible surfaces of it are upholstered. The colors are those of the inside of the body, the maroon of kidneys, the reddish-purple of hearts, the opaque blue of veins, the ivory of teeth and bones. He imagines the sensation it would produce if he were to announce this aperçu out loud. He is greeted by the governor's wife. She is a handsome woman of 45 or so, of an obvious respectability, but dressed in the hectic manner of the provinces, where the ladies appear to feel that if one row of lace and ruching is good, three must be better. She has the alarmed, slightly pop-eyed look that signals either an overly nervous disposition or a disease of the thyroid. "I am so glad you could honor us," she says. She tells him that the governor is regrettably away on business, but that she herself is deeply interested in the work he is doing. She has such a respect for modern science, and especially for modern medicine. Such a number of advances have been made, especially the ether, which has spared so much distress. She fixes him with a deep and meaningful gaze, and Simon sighs inwardly. He is familiar with that expression. She is about to make him an unsolicited gift of her symptoms. When he first received his medical degree, he was unprepared for the effect it would have on women, women of the better classes, married ladies especially, with blameless reputations. They seemed drawn to him as if he possessed some priceless but infernal treasure. Their interest was innocent enough. They had no intention of sacrificing their virtue to him. Yet they longed to entice him into shadowy corners, to converse with him in lowered voices, to confide in him, timorously, and with quavers, because he also inspired fear. What was the secret of his allure? The face he saw in the mirror, which was neither ugly nor handsome, could scarcely account for it. After a time he thought he knew. It was knowledge they craved, yet they could not admit to craving it, because it was forbidden knowledge, knowledge with a lurid glare to it, knowledge gained through a descent into the pit. He has been where they could never go, seen what they could never see. He has opened up women's bodies and peered inside. In his hand, which has just raised their own hands towards his lips, he may once have held a beating female heart. Thus he is one of the dark trio, the doctor, the judge, the executioner, and shares with them the powers of life and death. To be rendered unconscious, to lie exposed without shame at the mercy of others, to be touched, incised, plundered, remade, this is what they are thinking of when they look at him, with their widening eyes and slightly parted lips. "I suffer so terribly," the governor's wife's voice begins. Coyly, as if displaying an ankle, she relates a symptom, agitated breathing, a constriction around the ribs, with a hint of more and richer ones to follow. She has a pain. Well, she doesn't like to say exactly where. Whatever could be the cause of it? Simon smiles and says he is no longer practicing general medicine. After a momentary thwarted frown, the governor's wife smiles, too, and says she would like him to meet Mrs. Quinnell, the celebrated spiritualist and advocate of an enlarged sphere for women, and the leading light of our Tuesday discussion circle, as well as of the Spiritual Thursdays. Such an accomplished person and so widely traveled in Boston and elsewhere. Mrs. Quinnell, in her huge crinoline-supported skirt, resembles a lavender-colored Bavarian cream. Her head appears to be topped with a small gray poodle. In her turn, she presents Simon to Dr. Jerome DuPont of New York, who is visiting just now and who has promised to give a demonstration of his remarkable powers. "He is well known," said Mrs. Quinnell, "and has stayed with royalty in England, or not exactly royalty, but aristocratic families, all the same." "Remarkable powers?" says Simon politely. He would like to know what they are. Possibly the fellow claims to levitate, or personifies a dead Indian, or produces spirit wrappings like the celebrated Fox sisters. Spiritualism is the craze of the middle classes, the women especially. They gather in darkened rooms and play at table-tilting the way their grandmothers played at whist, or they emit voluminous automatic writings, dictated to them by Mozart or Shakespeare, in which case being dead, thinks Simon, has a remarkably debilitating effect on one's prose style. If these people were not well-to-do, their behavior would get them committed. Worse, they populate their drawing rooms with fakirs and mountebanks, all of them swathed in the grubby vestments of a self-proclaimed quasi-holiness, and the rules of society dictate that one must be polite to them. Dr. Jerome DuPont has the deep liquid eyes and intense gaze of a professional charlatan, but he smiles ruefully and gives a dismissive shrug. "Not very remarkable, I'm afraid," he says. He has a trace of a foreign accent. "Such things are merely another language. If one speaks it, one takes it simply for granted. It is others who find it remarkable." "You converse with the dead?" asks Simon, his mouth twitching. Dr. DuPont smiles. "Not I," he says. "I am what you might call a medical practitioner, or an investigative scientist like yourself. I am a trained neurohypnotist of the school of James Braid." "I have heard of him," says Simon. "A Scotsman, isn't he? A noted authority on clubfoot and strabismus, I believe. But surely professional medicine does not recognize these other claims of his. Is not this neurohypnotism simply the reanimated corpse of Mesmer's discredited animal magnetism?" "Mesmer posited a magnetic fluid encircling the body, which was certainly erroneous," says Dr. DuPont. "Braid's procedures involved the nervous system alone. I might add that those who dispute his methods have not tried them. They are more accepted in France, where the doctors are less prone to craven orthodoxies. They are more useful in hysterical cases than in others, of course. They cannot do much for a broken leg. But in cases of amnesia," he gives a faint smile, "they have frequently produced astounding and, I may say, very rapid results." Simon feels at a disadvantage and changes the subject. "DuPont, is it a French name?" "The family was French Protestant," says Dr. DuPont, "but only on the father's side. He was an amateur of chemistry. I myself am an American. I have visited France professionally, of course." "Perhaps Dr. Jordan would like to make one of our party," says Mrs. Quesnel, breaking in. "On our spiritual Thursdays, our dear governor's wife finds them such a comfort to know that her little one, now on the other side, is so well and happy. I am sure Dr. Jordan is a skeptic, but we always welcome skeptics." The tiny, bright eyes beneath the doggy coiffure twinkle roguishly at him. "Not a skeptic," says Simon. "Only a medical doctor. He has no intention of being lured into some compromising and preposterous rigmarole." He wonders what Verringer is thinking of to include such a woman on his committee. But, evidently, she is wealthy. "Physician, heal thyself," says Dr. DuPont. He seems to be making a joke. "Where do you stand on the abolitionist question, Dr. Jordan?" says Mrs. Quesnel. Now the woman is turning intellectual and will insist on a belligerent discussion of politics and will doubtless order him to abolish slavery in the South at once. Simon finds it tiresome to be constantly accused in his individual person of all the sins of his country, and especially by these Britishers who seem to think that a conscience recently discovered excuses them for not having had any conscience at all at an earlier period. On what was their present wealth founded but on the slave trade? And where would their great mill towns be without southern cotton? "My grandfather was a Quaker," he says. "As a boy, I was taught never to open cupboard doors in case some poor fugitive might be concealed within. He always felt that to put his own safety at risk was worth a good deal more than barking at others from behind the protection of a fence." "Stone walls do not a prison make," says Mrs. Quesnel gaily. "But all scientists must keep an open mind." says Dr. DuPont. He appears to be back in their previous conversation. I am sure Dr. Jordan's mind is as open as a book, says Mrs. Quinnell. You are looking into our grace, we are told, from the spiritual point of view. Simon can see that if he tries to explain the difference between the spirit, in her sense of the word, and the unconscious mind, in his, he will get hopelessly tangled. So he merely smiles and nods. What approach are you taking, says Dr. DuPont, to restore her vanished memory? I have begun, says Simon, with a method based on suggestion and the association of ideas. I am attempting gently and by degrees to reestablish the chain of thought which was broken, perhaps, by the shock of the violent events in which she was involved. Ah, says Dr. DuPont with a superior smile, slow but steady wins the race. Simon would like to kick him. We are sure she is innocent, says Mrs. Quinnell. All of us on the committee, we are convinced of it. Reverend Verringer is getting up a petition. It is not the first, but we are in hopes that this time we will be successful. Once more unto the breach is our motto. She gives a girlish wiggle. Do say you are on our side.
If at first you don't succeed, says Dr. DuPont solemnly.
I have not drawn any conclusions as yet, says Simon. In any case, I'm less interested in her guilt or innocence than in the mechanisms at work, says Dr. DuPont.
That is not quite how I would put it, says Simon.
It is not the tune played by the musical box, but the little cogs and wheels within it that concern you.
And you? Says Simon, who is beginning to find Dr. DuPont more interesting.
Ah, says DuPont, for me it is not even the box with its pretty pictures on the outside. For me it is only the music. The music is played by a physical object, and yet the music is not that object. As scripture says, the wind bloweth where it listeth.
St. John, says Mrs. Quinnell, that which is born of the spirit is spirit,
and that which is born of the flesh is flesh, says DuPont.
The two of them peer at him with an air of gentle but unanswerable triumph, and Simon feels as if he is suffocating under a mattress.
Dr. Jordan, says a soft voice at his elbow. It is Miss Lydia, one of the governor's wife's two daughters. Mama sent me to ask if you have yet seen her scrapbook.
Simon inwardly blesses his hostess and says he has not had that pleasure. The prospect of murky engravings of the beauty spots of Europe, their borders decorated with paper fern fronds, is not usually alluring to him, but at the moment it beckons like an escape. He smiles and nods and is led away. Miss Lydia places him on a tongue-colored settee, then fetches a book from the adjacent table and arranges herself beside him. She thought you might find it of interest because of whatever it is you're doing with Grace.
Oh, says Simon.
It has got all of the famous murders in it, Miss Lydia explains. My mother cuts them out and pastes them in, and the hangings, too.
Does she indeed? Asks Simon. The woman must be a ghoul as well as a hypochondriac.
It helps her to make up her mind as to which among the prisoners may be worthy objects of charity, says Miss Lydia. Here is Grace.
She opens the book across their knees and leans in his direction, gravely instructive.
I take an interest in her. She has remarkable abilities.
Like Dr. DuPont? Simon asks. Simon would like to kick him.
We are sure she is innocent, says Mrs. Quinnell. All of us on the committee, we are convinced of it. Reverend Verringer is getting up a petition. It is not the first, but we are in hopes that this time we will be successful. Once more unto the breach is our motto. She gives a girlish wiggle. Do say you are on our side.
If at first you don't succeed, says Dr. DuPont solemnly.
I have not drawn any conclusions as yet, says Simon. In any case, I'm less interested in her guilt or innocence than in
the mechanisms at work, says Dr. DuPont.
That is not quite how I would put it, says Simon.
It is not the tune played by the musical box, but the little cogs and wheels within it that concern you.
And you? Says Simon, who is beginning to find Dr. DuPont more interesting.
Ah, says DuPont. For me, it is not even the box with its pretty pictures on the outside. For me, it is only the music. The music is played by a physical object, and yet the music is not that object. As Scripture says, the wind bloweth where it listeth.
St. John, says Mrs. Cornell, that which is born of the Spirit is spirit,
and that which is born of the flesh is flesh, says DuPont.
The two of them peer at him with an air of gentle but unanswerable triumph, and Simon feels as if he is suffocating under a mattress.
Dr. Jordan, says a soft voice at his elbow. It is Miss Lydia, one of the governor's wife's two daughters. Mama sent me to ask if you have yet seen her scrapbook.
Simon inwardly blesses his hostess and says he has not had that pleasure. The prospect of murky engravings of the beauty spots of Europe, their borders decorated with paper fern fronds, is not usually alluring to him, but at the moment it beckons like an escape. He smiles and nods and is led away. Miss Lydia places him on a tongue-colored settee, then fetches a book from the adjacent table and arranges herself beside him. She thought you might find it of interest because of whatever it is you're doing with Grace.
Oh, says Simon.
It has got all of the famous murders in it, Miss Lydia explains. My mother cuts them out and pastes them in, and the hangings, too.
Does she indeed? Asks Simon. The woman must be a ghoul as well as a hypochondriac.
It helps her to make up her mind as to which among the prisoners may be worthy objects of charity, says Miss Lydia. Here is Grace.
She opens the book across their knees and leans in his direction, gravely instructive.
I take an interest in her. She has remarkable abilities.
Like Dr. DuPont?
Simon asks.
Miss Lydia stares. Oh, no. I do not go in for any of that. I would never let myself be hypnotized. It is so immodest. I mean that Grace has remarkable abilities as a dressmaker.
There is a subdued recklessness about her, thinks Simon. When she smiles, both bottom and top teeth show. But at least she is healthy-minded, unlike the mother, a healthy young animal. Simon is conscious of her white throat encircled with a modest ribbon ornamented with a rosebud, as befits an unmarried girl. Through layers of delicate fabric, her arm presses against his. He is not an insensible block, and although Miss Lydia's character, like that of all such girls, must be unformed and childish, she has a very small waist. A cloud of scent rises from her, lily of the valley, enveloping him in olfactory gauze. But Miss Lydia must be unconscious of the effect she is producing on him, being necessarily ignorant of the nature of such effects. He crosses his legs.
Here is the execution, says Miss Lydia, of James McDermott. It was in several of the newspapers. This one is the Examiner.
Simon reads. What a morbid appetite for such sights must exist in society when so large an assemblage in the present state of our roads had collected to witness the dying agony of an unfortunate but criminal fellow being. Can it be supposed that public morals are improved, or the tendency to the commission of flagrant crimes repressed by such public sights as these? I am inclined to agree, says Simon.
I would have attended it if I had been there, says Miss Lydia. Wouldn't you?
Simon is taken aback by such directness. He disapproves of public executions which are unhealthily exciting and produce bloodthirsty fancies in the weaker-minded part of the population. But he knows himself, and given the opportunity, his curiosity would have overcome his scruples. In my professional capacity, perhaps, he says cautiously. But I wouldn't have allowed my sister to attend, supposing I had one.
Miss Lydia widens her eyes.
But why not? She says.
Women should not attend such grisly spectacles, he says. They pose a danger to their refined natures. He's conscious of sounding pompous. In the course of his travels, he's encountered many women who could scarcely be accused of refined natures. He has seen mad women tearing off their clothes and displaying their naked bodies. He has seen prostitutes of the lowest sort do the same. He's seen women drunk and swearing, struggling together like wrestlers, pulling the hair from each other's heads. The streets of Paris and London swarm with them. He's known them to make away with their own infants, and to sell their young daughters to wealthy men who hope that by raping children they will avoid disease. So he is under no illusions as to the innate refinement of women, but all the more reason to safeguard the purity of those still pure. In such a case, hypocrisy is surely justified. One must present what ought to be true as if it really is.
Do you think I have a refined nature? Says Miss Lydia.
I am certain of it, says Simon. He wonders if that is her thigh he can feel against his, or only part of her dress.
I am sometimes not so sure, says Miss Lydia. There are people who say that Miss Florence Nightingale does not have a refined nature, or she would not have been able to witness such degrading spectacles without impairing her health. But she is a heroine.
There is no doubt of that, says Simon.
He suspects she's flirting with him. It's far from disagreeable, but perversely, it makes him think of his mother.
How many acceptable young girls has she trailed discreetly before him, like feathered fishing lures? She arranges them, always, next to a vase of white flowers. Their morals have been irreproachable, their manners candid as spring water. Their minds have been presented to him as unbaked pieces of dough, which it would be his prerogative to mold and form. As one season's crop of girls proceeds into engagement and marriage, younger ones keep sprouting up like tulips in May. They are now so young in relation to Simon that he has trouble conversing with them. It's like talking to a basketful of kittens. But his mother has always confused youth with malleability. What she really wants is a daughter-in-law who can be molded, not by Simon, but by herself. And so the girls continue to be floated past him, and he continues to turn away indifferently, and to be gently accused by his mother of laziness and ingratitude. He rebukes himself for it. He's a sad dog and a cold fish, and takes care to thank his mother for her pains and to reassure her. He will marry eventually, but he isn't ready for it yet. First, he must pursue his researches. He must accomplish something of value, discover something of note. He has his name to make. He already has a name, she sighs reproachfully, a perfectly good name, which he seems determined to exterminate by refusing to pass it on. At this point, she always coughs a little, to signify that his was a difficult birth which almost killed her and fatally weakened her lungs, a medically implausible effect which, during his boyhood, used to reduce him to a jelly of guilt. If he would only produce a son, she continues, having, of course, married first, she would die happy.
He teases her by saying that in that case it would be sinful of him to marry at all, since to do so would amount to matricide. And he adds, to soften the acerbity, that he can do much better without a wife than without a mother, and especially such a perfect mother as herself. At which she gives him a sharp look, which tells him she knows several tricks worth two of that, and is not deceived. He's too clever for his own good, she says. He needn't think he can get around her by flattery. But she's mollified. Sometimes he's tempted to succumb. He could choose one of her proffered young ladies, the richest one. His daily life would be orderly. His breakfasts would be edible. His children would be respectful. The act of procreation would be undergone unseen, prudently veiled in white cotton, she dutiful but properly averse, he within his rights, but need never be mentioned. His home would have all the modern comforts, and he himself would be sheltered in velvet. There are worse fates.
Do you think that Grace has one? Says Miss Lydia. A refined nature. I'm sure she did not do the murders, although she is sorry for not having told anyone about them afterwards. James McDermott must have been lying about her, but they say she was his paramour. Is it true?
Simon feels himself blushing. If she's flirting, she isn't conscious of it. She is too innocent to understand her lack of innocence. I couldn't say, he murmurs.
Perhaps she was abducted, says Miss Lydia dreamily. In books, women are always being abducted, but I have not personally known anyone that was. Have you?
Simon says he has never had such an experience.
They cut off his head,
Miss Lydia says in a lower voice. McDermott's. They have it in a bottle at the University of Toronto. Surely not, says Simon, disconcerted afresh. The skull may have been preserved, but surely not the entire head.
Like a big pickle, says Miss Lydia with satisfaction. Oh, look, Mama wants me to go and talk to Reverend Verringer. I would rather talk to you. He is so pedagogical. She thinks he's good for my moral improvement.
Reverend Verringer has indeed just come into the room and is smiling at Simon with annoying benevolence, as if Simon is his protégé, or perhaps he is smiling at Lydia. Simon watches Lydia as she glides across the room. She has that oiled walk they cultivate. Left to himself on the settee, he finds himself thinking of Grace as he sees her every weekday, seated opposite him in the sewing room. In her portrait, she looks older than she was, but now she looks younger. Her complexion is pale, the skin smooth and unwrinkled, and remarkably fine in texture, perhaps because she's been kept indoors, or it may be the sparse prison diet. She's thinner now, less full in the face, and whereas the picture shows a pretty woman, she is now more than pretty, or other than pretty. The line of her cheek has a marble, a classic simplicity. To look at her is to believe that suffering does indeed purify. But in the closeness of the sewing room, Simon can smell her as well as look at her. He tries to pay no attention, but her scent is a distracting undercurrent. She smells like smoke. Smoke and laundry soap and the salt from her skin. And she smells of the skin itself, with its undertone of dampness, fullness, ripeness. What? Ferns and mushrooms. Fruits crushed and fermenting. He wonders how often female prisoners are allowed to bathe. Although her hair is braided and coiled up under her cap, it too gives off an odor, a strong, musky odor of scalp. He is in the presence of a female animal, something fox-like and alert. He senses an answering alertness along his own skin, a sensation as of bristles lifting. Sometimes he feels as if he's walking on quicksand. Every day he has set some small object in front of her and has asked her to tell him what it causes her to imagine. This week he's attempted various root vegetables, hoping for a connection that will lead downwards. Beet, root cellar, corpses, for instance, or even turnip, underground grave. According to his theories, the right object ought to evoke a chain of disturbing associations in her, although so far she's treated his offerings simply at their face value, and all he's got out of her has been a series of cookery methods. On Friday, he tried a more direct approach. "You may be perfectly frank with me, Grace," he had said. "You need hold nothing back." "I have no reason not to be frank with you, sir," she said. "A lady might conceal things, as she has her reputation to lose. But I am beyond that."
"What do you mean, Grace?" he said.
"Only, I was never a lady, sir, and I've already lost whatever reputation I ever had. I can say anything I like, or if I don't wish to, I needn't say anything at all."
"You don't care about my good opinion of you, Grace."
She gave him a quick, sharp look, then continued her stitching. "I have already been judged, sir. Whatever you may think of me, it's all the same."
"Judged rightly, Grace?"
He could not resist asking.
"Rightly or wrongly does not matter," she said. "People want a guilty person. If there has been a crime, they want to know who did it. They don't like not knowing."
"Then you have given up hope."
"Hope of what, sir?" she asked mildly. Simon felt foolish, as if he'd committed a breach of etiquette.
"Well, hope of being set free."
"Now, why would they want to do that, sir?" she said.
"A murderess is not an everyday thing. As for my hopes, I save that for smaller matters. I live in hopes of having a better breakfast tomorrow than I had today."
She smiled a little. "They said at the time they were making an example of me. That's why it was the death sentence, and then the life sentence."
"But what does an example do afterwards?" thought Simon.
"Her story is over. The main story, that is. The thing that has defined her. How is she supposed to fill in the rest of the time?
Do you not feel you have been treated unjustly?" he said.
"I don't know what you mean, sir."
She was threading the needle now. She wet the end of the thread in her mouth to make it easier. And this gesture seemed to him all at once both completely natural and unbearably intimate. He felt as if he was watching her undress through a chink in the wall, as if she was washing herself with her tongue, like a cat.
5. Broken Dishes. "My name is Grace Marks, and I am the daughter of John Marks, who lives in the township of Toronto, and he is a stonemason by trade. We came to this country from north of Ireland about 3 years ago. I have 4 sisters and 4 brothers, 1 sister and 1 brother older than I am. I was 16 years old last July. I have lived servant during the 3 years I have been in Canada at various places."
Voluntary confession of Grace Marks to Mr. George Walton in the jail on the 17th of November, 1843, Star and Transcript, Toronto. "All the 17 years, not once did a suspicion visit me how very different a lot is mine from any other woman's in the world. The reason must be 'twas by step and step it got to grow so terrible and strange. These strange woes stole on tiptoe, as it were, into my neighborhood and privacy. Sat down where I sat, laid them where I lay, and I was found familiarized with fear. When friends broke in, held up a torch and cried, 'Why, you Pompilia in the cavern thus, how came that arm of yours about a wolf? And the soft length lies in and out your feet and laps you round the knee. A snake it is.' And so on."
Robert Browning, The Ring and the Book, 1869. This is the ninth day I have sat with Dr. Jordan in this room. The days haven't been all in a row, as there are Sundays, and on some other days he did not come. I used to count from my birthdays, and then I counted from my first day in this country, and then from Mary Whitney's last day on earth, and after that, from the day in July when the worst things happened, and after that I counted from my first day in prison.